Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Telltale Heart, the Pharmacist Cardiovascular Digest. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Beavers. If you've noticed, we've had a gap in episodes, and part of that was because I was trying to wait for the European Society of Cardiology Congress that opened up this weekend in Munich, Germany. And today we're directly going to talk about the first hotline sessions that were presented overnight for us in America. And this was quite a way to start the meeting. Five trials were presented this morning that touch almost every corner of cardiovascular practice: cardiac amyloidosis, atrial fibrillation anticoagulation, infective endocarditis, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and prevention of sudden cardiac death. And we're going to really talk about first two trials and then really about hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. The five trials that were presented are CardioTransform, evaluating eplontersen and ATTR cardiomyopathy; Single AF, asking whether we should anticoagulate patients with atrial fibrillation who have traditionally been considered at only intermediate risk for stroke; POET2, challenging how long we actually need to treat select patients with infective endocarditis; Acadia HCM, evaluating aficamten in symptomatic non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy; and CMR guide, asking whether cardiac MRI can identify those with ejection fractions above 35% who nevertheless benefit from ICD. We won't talk about that trial really in depth. What I do want to do in this episode is go beyond simply telling you what each trial was positive or negative. We're going to talk about what actually was studied, what the results were, what the limitations are, how I interpret these findings, and perhaps most importantly for the podcast, what does this mean for pharmacists and cardiovascular clinicians taking care of the patients? And there are some surprises here, so let's get started. CardioTransform, eplontersen, and ATTR cardiomyopathy. Let's begin with the most anticipated studies of the meeting, and this is where we'll transition. This is particularly important because the treatment landscape for ATTR cardiomyopathy has changed dramatically. We've moved from an area where ATTR cardiomyopathy was frequently missed and essentially untreatable to an area where we have transthyretin stabilizers and gene silencing strategies. CardioTransform tested whether another TTR-lowering approach could improve clinical outcomes. And eplontersen is an antisense oligonucleotide designed to reduce hepatic production of transthyretin. It's administered subcutaneously at a dose of 45 milligrams every 4 weeks. The trial enrolled 1,432 patients with either wild-type or hereditary ATTR cardiomyopathy across 130 centers in 20 countries. The mean age was 72 years. And something important for interpreting this trial is 57% of patients were already receiving a TTR stabilizer at baseline. Patients were randomized 1-to-1 to eplontersen or placebo on top of available standard of care. The primary endpoint is a composite of cardiovascular mortality and recurrent cardiovascular events through approximately 140 weeks. And here's the headline. The trial did not meet its primary endpoint. There were 381 primary endpoint events among 210 patients assigned to treatment, compared to 392 events amongst the 231 patients receiving placebo. The rate ratio is 0.89 with a 95% confidence interval of 0.73 to 1.09 with a p-value of 0.277. So despite eplontersen doing what it was pharmacologically designed to do, which was showed by substantially suppressing circulation levels of transthyretin, this did not translate into a significant reduction in the primary clinical endpoint in the overall trial population. But here's where it gets interesting. Remember the 57% of patients entered the study having TTR stabilized therapy? In the pre-specified subgroup of patients not receiving stabilizer therapy, few primary endpoints occurred, with eplontersen than placebo reaching nominal statistical significance. But among those already receiving stabilizer therapy, there was no clear incremental benefit from adding the therapy. And I think that observation may ultimately be more interestingly scientifically than simply labeling CardioTransform as a negative trial. So the clinical interpretation, there's at least three lessons here. First, biologically effective dose does not necessarily equal clinical efficacy. Eplontersen lowered TTR, but lowering a biomarker, even dramatically affecting the underlying biological pathway, is not enough. What matters is whether patients live longer, stay out of the hospital, function better, or feel better. Second, this trial increasingly raises an important question: ATTR cardiomyopathy. Is more disease-modifying therapy necessarily better? We now have stabilizers designed to prevent tetramer disassociation and silencers designed to reduce TTR production. Mechanistically, combining these approaches seems appealing, but this trial reminds us that mechanistic complementarity does not always automatically mean additive clinical benefit. Third, background therapy matters enormously when interpreting contemporary cardiovascular trials. Ethereum might have demonstrated a substantial effect 10 years ago when there were few disease-modifying options, but demonstrating incremental benefit becomes progressively harder as the standard of care improves. What does this mean for pharmacists? For pharmacists involved in amyloid programs or treating amyloid patients, I would not view this trial as an argument against gene silencing therapy as a therapeutic strategy. Instead, I think it reinforces the importance of asking, what therapy is the patient already receiving? What evidence supports the specific treatment or combination? What is the incremental clinical benefit? What additional monitoring and administration burdens are we creating? And what is the cost associated with adding another high-cost disease-modifying therapy? This becomes especially relevant as ATTR treatment evolves for simply asking, can we treat the patient, to asking, what is the optimal sequence or combination of treatments for the particular patient? And cardiotransformation tells us that we can no longer assume combination therapy is better simply because of the mechanisms are complementary. Let's now transition to single AF. This second study may have very immediate implications for clinical practice. Single AF asked as a remarkable practical question, should patients with atrial fibrillation who have only an intermediate risk of stroke receive oral anticoagulation? Current guidelines clearly recommend anticoagulation for the patients at sufficiently high thrombotic risk. The uncertainty has always been what to do with those patients sitting just below that threshold. Single AF enrolled 1,803 patients with atrial fibrillation and intermediate stroke risk defined in the study as CHADS2 VAS score of 1 in men or 2 in women, and patients were randomized to receive a direct oral anticoagulant, either apixaban 5 mg twice daily or rivaroxaban 20 mg once daily and no anticoagulation, and the results were striking. At 24 months, the primary composite endpoint of stroke, systemic embolism, major bleeding, or cardiovascular death occurred in 0.5% of those receiving DOAC versus, and that's direct-acting oral anticoagulant, versus 1.5% with no anticoagulation. That corresponded to a hazard ratio of 0.31 with a 95% confidence interval from 0.1 to 0.94 and a p-value of 0.028. That's a 69% relative risk reduction in the primary endpoint. The difference appeared to be driven primarily by ischemic stroke, with 0.1% with DOAC therapy versus 1.1% without anticoagulation, and importantly, major bleeding was not increased. 0.3% of anticoagulation versus 0.5% without anticoagulation. Now let's put that into perspective. That relative risk reduction is dramatic, but there were low-risk patients, so the absolute event rates were also low. The absolute reduction in the composite endpoint was about 1% percentage point over 2 years, which gives us rough numbers needed to treat of about 100 over 2 years. For ischemic stroke specifically, the absolute difference was also approximately 1 percentage point. That's an important distinction. When we discuss single AF with patients, saying anticoagulation reduces events by 69% sounds enormous, and relatively it is, but shared decision-making requires communication both relative and absolute risk. So why does this trial matter? Historically, clinicians have appropriately worried that anticoagulating low-risk patients might simply exchange a small reduction in stroke for an increased bleeding. Single AF did not show that trade-off. Major bleeding was uncommon. It was not increased in the anticoagulation arm. This shift backs the risk-benefit conversation, but I would be cautious about immediately anticoagulating every patient with immediate risk AF tomorrow morning. This is an open-label study in 18 sitters in South Korea. The absolute number of events were small, and patient characteristics and bleeding risk may differ across populations, so please take that with caution. So external validity is going to matter. The pharmacist implications? This is exactly the type of population where pharmacists can make a major contribution. Don't just calculate a risk score once and forget about it. Stroke is a risk, it's dynamic. Age changes, hypertension develops, diabetes develops, vascular disease occurs, kidney function changes, bleeding risk changes, medication burden changes. So pharmacists involved in anticoagulation stewardship should think about longitudinal AF risk surveillance, not simply one-time anticoagulation decisions. And if single AF influences further guidelines, we may see the threshold for anticoagulation more earlier in selected patients. POET2 is interesting. So can we treat endocarditis for less time? Well, let's move into antimicrobial stewardship, a different version of this. POET2 may sound less glamorous than a new cardiovascular drug, but from a health system perspective, this could be an enormously important study. For decades, infective endocarditis was generally meant prolonged antibiotic therapy, often 4 to 6 weeks. The original POET trial already challenged one major assumption by showing that carefully selected, clinically stable patients with left-sided infective endocarditis could transition from intravenous therapy to oral therapy. POET2 asked the next logical question. Do all these patients actually need long courses of antibiotics? The investigators enrolled 508 clinically stable patients with left-sided infective endocarditis caused by Staphylococcus aureus, Enterococcus faecalis, or Streptococci. Patients were randomized to standard therapy or a response-tailored strategy. In the Taylor group, antibiotics could be discontinued once the patient completed a predefined minimum treatment duration, generally 2 or 4 weeks, satisfied established stabilization criteria. The difference in antibiotics exposure was substantial. Median duration was 26 days with tailored therapy versus 41 days with standard therapy. That's a reduction of 50 days, or approximately one-third the total treatment duration. The primary endpoint with days alive and free from antibiotic treatment during 6 months was significantly greater with tailored therapy. It was 183 days versus 169 days. And importantly, the major safety component of all-cause mortality, unplanned valve surgery, or symptomatic embolic events occurred in 8.2% with tailored therapy versus 10.7% with standard therapy. The tailored strategy met its non-inferior criteria. But there's an important caution. Relapse was more frequent in shorter therapy, 5.1% versus 1.6%. That difference was statistically significant with a p-value of 0.04. More relapse could be managed by restarting antibiotics, but I would not dismiss this signal. That is why I would resist the headline, "We only need 26 days of antibiotics for endocarditis." That is not what POET2 demonstrated. It demonstrated that carefully selected, clinically stable patients who meet predefined response criteria may be candidates for individualized short-duration therapy. Those are very different statements. The pharmacist's perspective, the trial belongs squarely in antimicrobial stewardship. Think about eliminating approximately 2 weeks of therapy could mean less intravenous access, fewer line complications, less drug toxicity, potentially less nephrotoxicity, fewer drug interactions, less monitoring, lower antimicrobial exposure, reduced hospitalizations or outpatient parenteral antibiotic therapy, lower costs, and potentially better quality of life. But pharmacists also need to help make sure shorter therapy does not become indiscriminate shorter therapy. Patient selection matters. Organisms matters. Source control matters. Valve involvement matters. Clinical stability matters. Microbiology matters. And imaging matters. And the follow-up matters, especially given the relapse signal. So POET2 is simply not an antibiotic duration trial. It's another example of cardiovascular care moving to response-guided precision therapy rather than fixed-duration treatment. So the last trial we'll talk about is Acadia-HCM, or aficamten, and non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy. Now let's talk about why this may be the most exciting positive trial from the morning. Cardiac myosin inhibitors have already changed how we think about obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, but non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy has remained an enormous therapeutic challenge. These patients can have significant dyspnea, fatigue, exercise intolerance, diastolic dysfunction, elevated filling pressures, and impaired quality of life, despite not having significant LV outflow tract obstructions or left ventricular outflow tract obstructions. And importantly, there currently isn't an approved therapy specifically targeting the underlying disease, physiology, and symptomatic non-obstructive HCM. In this trial, they were enrolled 517 adults with symptomatic non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy at 182 international sites. The mean age was 55 years, and about 54% were women, and the baseline ejection fraction was approximately 68%. Patients were randomized to aficamten or placebo, and aficamten dose adjusted according to left ventricular ejection fraction. There were two primary endpoints at 36 weeks: change in Kansas City Cardiomyopathy Questionnaire Clinical Summary Score, or KCCQ-CCS, and change in peak oxygen consumption, or PVO2, and both primary endpoints were met. Symptoms improved on the KCCQ, 11.4 points with aficamten versus 8.4 with placebo, and these differences were significant by a p-value of 0.02. Interestingly, symptoms improvement appeared by approximately 12 weeks, and symptoms worsened again with aficamten was discontinued, strengthening the argument that was observed improvement represented a true treatment effect. And in terms of exercise capacity, peak VO2 increased by 0.64 milliliters per kilogram per minute with aficamten versus essentially no change, minus 0.03 milliliters per kilogram per minute with placebo, and the p-value equals 0.03. The trial also showed improvement in several secondary endpoints, including New York Heart Association functional class, measure of submaximal exercise performance, or NT-proBNP. In terms of safety, there is, however, an important safety consideration. An LVF below 50% occurred in approximately 10% of those receiving aficamten versus 1% in placebo, and these reductions were managed through dose adjustment. And that is going to matter if this therapy enters routine practice. So why is this important? This is more than just another positive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy study. It provides proof of concept that excessive sarcomeric activity remains therapeutically relevant when a patient does not have significant outflow obstruction. That expands our understanding of the disease. For years, treatment of non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy is focused on managing symptoms, comorbidities, and such. And this trial suggests that directly modifying sarcomeric function can improve how patients feel and how they perform physiologically. And that combination is important. Patients reported and symptoms improved, objective exercise performance improved, New York Heart Association class improved, and biomarkers improved. When multiple independent measures point in the same direction, the overall signal becomes more convincing. But keep that magnitude in perspective. The placebo group improved also substantially in KCCQ, so the between group difference was around 3 points. Likewise, the increase in peak VO2 was statistically significant but quantitatively modest. The question regulators, guideline committees, clinicians, and patients will ultimately need to answer, are these improvements clinically meaningful enough to justify chronic therapy, monitoring requirements, potential systolic dysfunction, and cost? That's a more nuanced question than simply asking a p-value. For pharmacists, if aficamten ultimately becomes available for non-obstructive hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, pharmacists could have an important role in implementation. We will need a system for baseline cardiac assessment, LVEF monitoring, dose titration, identifying reduced systolic dysfunction, medication reconciliation, evaluating concomitant therapies and drug interactions, patient counseling adherence, and coordination between specialty pharmacy, cardiology, imaging, and the HCM team. In the LVEF, or the left ventricular ejection fraction, finding in this study reinforces a principle we've learned across the myosin inhibitor class. They are simply not prescribe it and forget it medications. They require infrastructure, and health system needs to build that immediately. So, what did we learn from these hotline sessions? I think several themes connecting them, very different studies. Number one, negative trials still teach us something. CardioTransform is neutral overall. We should not forget about that and throw it in the negative bucket. It tells us a lot about treatment. Number two, precision medicine increasingly means precision patient selection. We saw that with POET. We see that with single AF and also with our Acadia HCM. And lastly, absolute risk still matters. And really, the most important for all of us, health system implementation matters as much as efficacy in building this infrastructure. And so that's what I would like to take. So again, we'll keep doing this journey through ESE as we have more data and trials. I hope you enjoyed this overview and a timely catch-up. And if you have any likes, subscribes for the podcast, please do. Please let us know if you have feedback. We're here to always make this better. And we'll keep going along around this journey with the European Society of Cardiology meeting. Thank you for joining.